This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. For my last reading of Eels, an exploration from New Zealand to the Sargasso of the World's Most Mysterious Fish by James Prosek, we'll return to the Weir on the east branch of the Delaware River in the Catskills of New York, and to Ray Turner, who has devoted his life to reading the river, the weather, and the seasons, and makes his living by successfully trapping native North American eels on their migration to the sea. He has moved huge and small stones and constructed and reconstructed this weir, a horizontal funnel with arms that reach hundreds of feet upriver in a V shape, to direct the eels to an elaborate device where he can collect them over only about 2 days in September. He's one of the few people still licensed to do this kind of commercial fishing. I read much more about Ray in the second of my readings from this book. You can find all of them archived at wdrt.org under Archived Podcasts. So on to Chapter 8, Weir Hollow. Our intrepid author Prosek has been keeping in close touch with Ray Turner and visited him frequently over the months, and has found that due to weather conditions for 2 years in a row, the eel's migration has come and gone without any catch, in spite of all the work Turner has done each year to be ready. In late June, I was in the Catskills for a friend's wedding in the hamlet of Oliveria. After a beautiful, cool evening, the day had turned pleasantly warm. I decided to steal away from the party and drive over the mountain into Hancock. When I arrived at Ray's home, there was a handwritten note on the smokehouse door to anyone who might happen by. "Come out to the river's edge and wave," it said. I walked down the path beside the house to Green Flats and the riverbank, took off my shirt, and waded out into the Delaware. I let myself drop into the currents and drifted gently down before standing up on a large flat boulder to look upstream. The weir was broad and distant, framed by the hills of the magnificent valley. Standing in the water above the weir was a slim figure I recognized as Ray. Ray doesn't wear a watch, but he has a sundial out by the weir, a nail driven upright on a level piece of the eel rack. Out on the river, though, if you ask, he'll say, "It's summertime." He wore a frayed white t-shirt and cut-off jeans. His face and arms were tan. It seemed he was charged directly by the sun. He showed me his fingernails, ground down to nothing, from chinking, taking handfuls of gravel and piling them up on the inside of the weir. Normally in summer, he said, he worked with his secret weapon, an 18-year-old named Jamie. "He's worked like a real soldier this year," Ray said. Even though Ray didn't have the best experience in the Army, he had picked up the lingo, using words such as reconnoiter, soldier, and vanguard. He often talked about his time in basic training at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, and in Panama, blowing things up, his fights with the sergeant about overworking the men in 105-degree heat without water, his being caught with contraband, and being honorably discharged. Typical of Ray's Catskill humor, he hung the discharge certificate over his toilet. The engineering he'd learned in the Army, he uses in his everyday work. To him, nature is full of engineers, birds building nests, beavers building dams, caddisflies building cases of sand and silk, and he's just another one of them. "I've been asked, why don't you bring in a dozer?" Ray said. "That totally goes against the point of the operation. Myself or my friends have touched every one of the stones that go into the wall. That's significant." Ray paused and looked up at the sun, his shirt and shoulders wet with river water. I followed him to his canoe, where he had some food in a cooler. He unwrapped a small piece of smoked eel from some tinfoil, tore off a piece for me, and ate a bit himself. It was sweet like honeysuckle and made your fingers glisten with oil. As the summer sun warmed our shoulders, we sat on the rack and nibbled on smoked eel. I told Ray that back in April I'd attended a hearing in Old Lyme, Connecticut, organized by the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, ASMFC, to discuss the status of the North American eel population. Ray said he'd gone to a similar ASMFC meeting in April in Narrowsburg, New York, about 2 hours from his home. More such meetings were taking place up and down the East Coast, Virginia to Maine, prompted by a citizen's petition to list the freshwater eel as an endangered species under the Endangered Species Act. The petition to list was submitted by two brothers from Massachusetts, Doug and Tim Watts, who had grown concerned about the eel's precipitous decline. Commercial landings for eels were the lowest on record, not just in North America, but worldwide. Ray had more immediate concerns than a decline in the eel population, namely maintenance on his house, cutting and splitting wood for the smokehouse, fixing his truck, his health, building the walls of the weir and the rack for the fall season, and hoping that a flood would not ruin his catch for the third year in a row. There were easier ways to make a living. I almost felt like he would continue to operate the weir whether the eels showed up or not. That day, I helped Ray shift, tilt, and tumble some of the larger stones into place using an iron bar as a lever. A few dead shad, summer casualties of the rack, littered the bottom like silver coins in a wishing well. Two bald eagles sat patiently in the trees above us, waiting for the shad that they would take as soon as we cleared the area. At some point, it occurred to me that I'd better return to my friend's wedding in Oliveria. Late that summer, Ray spoke confidently about the work he'd done on the weir. Cosmetically and functionally, it was the finest one he'd ever built. "The weir is at a place where it's close to done," he told me over the phone. "The anxiety is gone. Now I can just go up there to admire and tinker." The large flat paving stones that sloped on the outside of the weir's walls were seamlessly fitted. The pebble-sized gravel on the inside of the walls, the chinking, was in place and had been further sealed by leaves of Japanese knotweed that floated downstream, torn off their stalks by beavers. "Nature's black plastic," Ray called it. The curve of each of the two convex walls was the best he'd ever created, forming a braid of currents at the vortex of the trap with just the right pull to coax the eels. Over the years, Ray has learned through experience that straight walls are not as efficient as curved walls. He had made improvements to the wooden rack as well. The eels would still be caught underneath the overlapping lips of each slatted ramp, but in the pockets where he would normally have stood all night using a dip net to scoop the captured eels into a canoe, he put escape paths of PVC piping that led the eels into a big cage, a holding pen with a top. He could now empty each night's catch the morning after the run in the light of day while relieving stress on the rack and keeping predators such as eagles, herons, osprey, and bears from stealing his fish when he wasn't looking. The beautiful condition of the weir and Ray's pride in his creation seemed to promise a fruitful catch. Now the weather needed to cooperate. In late August, a large tropical storm began to form in the Caribbean and eventually morphed into a full-blown hurricane. I called Ray in the morning of August 29th, and he answered with his customary greeting, "Smokehouse! Hey, Ray, it's James. What can I do for you, Jimmy?" "Well, I see there's a storm coming. Wanted to check in." "There's a band of rain from central Pennsylvania to the Yucatan," Ray said. "Based on my experience, I'd have my boots on for tomorrow night." I got in my car and headed to Hancock. The weather forecasters were noncommittal about the path of the storm, now a Category 4 hurricane called Katrina. But the system was carrying a lot of water, enough to trigger eel runs on every major East Coast river in domino-like fashion from south to north. A week before the first drop of rain fell, before the hurricane had even touched the Gulf Coast, the eels in the Delaware River had begun to move. The early eels Ray called Vanguard eels. By August 29th, Ray had caught 926 eels, more than he'd ever taken by that date. Only the year 2000 had been close, with 840. Just look at the numbers, Ray said, one eye on his logbook, one eye on the Weather Channel in his living room. That storm is hundreds of miles away, and they know it's coming. It had begun to rain, and all through the night the rain continued, but by dawn the river had risen only slightly. The land was very dry and thirsty for the water, and the reservoir upstream was below capacity. We spent the day preparing, cleaning out the canoes, filling buckets with salt, draining the eel tank, and filling it with fresh water. Toward nightfall, we returned to Ray's house for a dinner of pancakes, oatmeal and corn, flour and bisquick, and raisins. It was pretty tasty. Ray offered me a beer while he himself drank out of a large mason jar, a 50-50 mix of orange juice and water with a can of ginger ale. After dinner, he sat in his chair by the fire and clipped his toenails, a lit cigarette in his mouth. Ray placed a tray on his lap and rolled two cigarettes for our trip upstream. We walked down the riverbank to where he had his canoes tied up. We each got in one and paddled upstream. It was a warm, dark night. The new moon was only 3 days away, and a low mist hung over the water. The air was filled with the damp smell of early autumn, though in daylight the trees had only hints of turning color. The sound of the current was still gentle, but the rain continued to fall lightly, teasing the hope that at some point the river would rise, but not rise too much. We walked along the walls of the weir, our eyes adjusted enough to see the beauty of his workmanship. Near the base of the rack, the walls were 10 feet thick. He tapped the rim of his baseball cap in homage to Jamie, the young man who had helped him most that summer. Jamie did this in a truly soldier fashion, Ray said, pointing out a particular feature of the wall. We climbed onto the damp and slippery slatted ramps, where the eels are actually trapped. Looking upstream, I could see clearly the two arms of the weir and the smooth surface of the river above the V. The river made a soft, thundering sound as the braid of water funneled through what Ray called the slip drop into the rack and out beneath under our feet. I helped Ray clear the ramps of debris, sticks, and knotweed leaves, and then we sat at the top of the rack under a rain fly he'd rigged to stay dry while we waited for the eels. Ray took one of the cigarettes he'd been keeping under his hat, lit it, took a puff, and stared off at the mountain. You can stay here till midnight, Ray said, and you've had the whole experience. He passed me the lit cigarette. It was shaped like a snake that had swallowed a mouse. I was mesmerized by the sound of the rain on the tarp over our heads and the droning of the waterfall created by the rack. I've been to heaven, Ray said, and this is it. He'd once told me that his ideal death would be to drown in the river. I wonder where they're going, I said after a pause. They're going someplace, Ray said. A warm breeze blew through the rack. In the hours until midnight, we didn't see any eels come into the trap. I spent the night at my friend's cabin across the river in Pease Eddy and was back at Ray's house in the morning. At about 8 o'clock, I found the eel fisherman at the start of his routine. Make coffee, feed the emu, check the eels in the tank, have a cigarette, watch the Weather Channel, as he himself described it. We spent the whole day on the river. It rained all morning, and then the rain let up. Before our eyes, the clear river began to rise and get color, a milky bluish green as an overture to muddy brown. Ray was nearly certain now that the run was going to happen that night, or at least a good preliminary push of fish. Ray and I went upstream after dark to check the weir. There was noticeably more water coming through the slip drop into the rack at about 9 o'clock than there had been the night before at the same time. We stood in the wooden structure of the rack, the rising water thundering beneath our feet, in the foamy waterfall glistening in the darkness where the river met the ramps of the rack. I suddenly saw a shimmering black and silver fish shimmy up the wooden slats and tumble into the trap. Another came over the ramp, then another and another. It was what I'd come here to see. It was happening. The run. I started down from the top of the rack to the slippery part where the eels were coming over, Before I could get to the waterfall, Ray urged me to turn away. "Let's go back, kid," he said to me. I was surprised and torn. This was Ray's weir. How could I stand out here without him? But I'd come here to see this wonder of nature. Over the years, I'd imagined what it would be like, a surge of life down the river. I stopped moving toward the water as more eels came over the top of the slats, unable to beat the force of the falls and the shelf of wood over their heads to get back. "I'll call Jimmy in the morning to come down and help transfer the eels." "You don't want to stay out?" I asked, needing to say something. "Oh, there's no reason to. They'll all be in the holding cage in the morning. You're going to need sleep. Tomorrow we'll be bringing eels down to the house for half a day, carrying them bucket after bucket by the hundreds up the hill from Green Flats to the tank. And the tank as it is overflowing with fish. I'm going to have to rig up another tub with an aerator and then hope the power doesn't go out. And if there's still time, we'll start processing these eels to make room for more." I felt powerless. Was it all business, a military operation? Was it more efficient to leave the weir so that we would be well rested for the work the next day? Or was it something else? I couldn't help but wonder if Ray wanted the brunt of the run to remain veiled, and whether it had to do with the sanctity of what he called Mother Nature. Out of respect, I did not question his decision further. In the 4 years that young Jamie Gallietta had worked with Ray, this was the first run he'd witnessed. The previous two seasons, the trap had been blown out, and the times before that, he'd been in school. Ray was generous and social, not simply the odd recluse I had first imagined him to be. Of all his friends, Ray talked most about Jamie, but it was the first time I'd met him. He was a modest and quiet, strong young man with a shaved head and a handsome appearance. "What qualifies it as a run?" I asked Ray that morning. "If it's close to 1,000, he said, "that's a run." We made our way up to the weir with anticipation. Ray and Jamie paddled up in one canoe and I walked up the riverbank, wading out in the high water to meet them at the trap. After tying the canoe to the rack, Ray climbed up onto the wooden structure. Jamie and I followed. "See that?" he said, running his hand over the wooden latticework, water gushing between the slats. "That's eel slime." He then pointed to scratch marks visible against the wet wood, and that's where Baldy tried to get at the eels. The talon marks on the wood of the rack had been made that morning. Upstream, one massive, white-headed perpetrator was sitting in a tree looking at us. "He can see these fish," Ray said. "Probably got a few. Their vision is incredible." Ray opened up the top of the cage and sank his dip net to the bottom. Jamie and I steadied the canoe, watching as Ray ran the head of his net this way and that. Finally, he pulled up the net by the handle. It was loaded with beautiful silver eels. "There's a lot of them, boys," Ray said, shouting over the rushing water, dumping them into the boat. "Take a look. The bottom of the cage is black with their backs." Ray kept loading the canoe with fish until the bottom was covered. The eels banged and clanked against the hull, snaking up the gunwales, unable to get out. The three of us, wading along the shoreline, carefully guided the canoe load of eels downstream to Green Flats. When we got back, Ray gave orders. He would stay with the canoe at the riverbank and unload the eels into buckets. I would carry the buckets up to the smokehouse, and Jamie would count the eels one by one as he dumped them into the tub. It took several trips to the weir and most of the morning to get all the eels up to the smokehouse. 749 fish had tumbled into the trap in the previous 10 hours or so, more in one night than the totals for each of the previous 2 years. So far that year, Ray had caught 1,758 eels, all of which were alive in the wooden tank outside the smokehouse, the slats dripping water and covered with moss. The tank, like a big barrel cut in half, Ray told me, was from an old trout hatchery made by a silo company in Unadilla, New York. "We should get as many eels again tonight," Ray said. He was afraid he'd run out of space to hold them, so for the rest of the afternoon, Ray and Jamie began the work of processing the eels to make room for more. Time and again I visited Ray. Initially, I had wanted to see the run, but after that objective came and went, I found myself returning to Green Flats anyway. Maybe it wasn't the run I was interested in so much as Ray. Or maybe he was the run, the persistence to live life, to rebuild the walls in the face of life's hurdles. No matter, I felt sometimes as though there was nothing to learn or figure out, really, just stuff to take in. I told Ray once that I admired the way he lived. "Don't look up to me, kid," he said. "Look with me." Nowhere else did his homespun aphorisms make more sense than when I stood on the river beside him and heard the words come out of his mouth as he was lifting those stones. "It's not the journey, it's the road." Or, "Art is nature out of proportion." I helped Ray with some odds and ends one day in June, and toward evening I drove into town to get us a pizza. Ray was appreciative of the treat. He offered me a beer. "Why'd you quit drinking?" I asked him. "Let's see," Ray said. "Was it the time we were in the toboggan being towed behind a truck in the snow and we went off the road and hit a tree? Or all the times I crashed my car in hit and runs? Or was it the time I got up in the middle of the night not knowing where I was and fell out of my bed? Mind you, my bed is 10 feet off the ground, and nearly gouged my eye out on the corner of the dresser? I haven't had a drink in 19 years. One day I ran into a childhood friend of Ray's named Ken Mason, who lived up Pizzetti Road. Ken had been described to me as a thinker who went up every day into the woods to read books. I told Ken I'd been visiting with Ray, and he shared some insights into Ray's life. "My sister Janet lived at Green Flats with Ray in the late 70s for 3 years," Ken said. "She tended the garden and lived barefoot. Hippies, you know." I asked Ken why he thought Ray lived out there alone. "The beavers come up into the Oxbow near Pizzetti," Ken said. "They build their dams every year, and every year the ice and spring floods scour them out." I saw where Ken was going with his metaphor. "Why does he keep rebuilding the weir year after year?" I asked Ken. "What gives him the energy?" "Pure and simple," Ken said. "Freedom." And that's the end of chapter 8 about Ray Turner. And that's the end of my reading from the book Eels, An Exploration from New Zealand to the Sargasso of the World's Most Mysterious Fish by James Prosek, published in 2010. James Prosek is also an artist and has published some beautiful books that he illustrated about trout. If you love trout, you will love his books. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thanks for listening.